Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. In today's podcast, Mike Seymour is going to talk with Rob Cook, Vice President of Pixar Animation Studios. For those who don't know Rob, he's the co-architect and primary author of Pixar's RenderMan. In 2001, he was one of the winners of the first Oscar ever given for software for RenderMan. It's a really great discussion of CG and a discussion about technology and art and how they challenge each other and spur growth. I think you'll enjoy it. So let's go now to Mike with Rob Cook from Pixar.
So Rob, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Am I right in thinking it was 76 that you went to your first SIDGRAPH when you were still writing code for intensive care? Is that correct?
That's right. I was working in an intensive care unit at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. And I had heard of computer graphics a little bit, but I didn't know about SIDGRAPH or anything like that. And I went to lunch one day and came back, and there was a sign up saying computer graphics this computer graphics conference. So I followed the sign and went to the exhibit hall, which was in the top room of a dormitory and had, I think, six or eight tabletop displays in it. And that was the exhibits for SIDGRAPH that year.
If one was to visit Pixar today and actually go around to your render farm, at the very front of the render farm is an original Pixar image computer. Mm-hmm. And I wondered whether the medical imaging history of Pixar, which is not often touched on, was related to your intensive care experience in any way directly.
You know, it'd be nice to think so, but actually it's not at all. What's interesting about it, if I can go back to the 76
sure.
Conference first, is so that day I went to this exhibits, and then I came back from lunch and went back to my job, and later got a job at Digital Equipment, and where there was one person doing computer graphics, and they actually wanted to do medical imaging, and so they went off and did that, and told me, because I wanted to do computer graphics, they said, oh, you should go to this conference. So I went to SIDGRAPH 78, by which time it was this huge, but compared to 76, it was huge and much more exciting. And I didn't put the two together until later that actually had been SIGGRAPH that I'd gone to, this little tiny thing, because it was very small in 76, and by 78 it was really quite big. But I got a job at Digital Equipment, and then went after SIGGRAPH in 78, met Don Greenberg at Cornell, met Alvy Ray Smith and Ed Catmull, and decided that I wanted to go back into school in computer graphics, and went to Cornell for graduate school. So that was sort of the end of the medical connection for me until much later, when it was Lauren Carpenter and Bob Drebin did the first volume rendering of medical data. They did CAT scan data, reconstruction of CAT scan slices to make 3D volumes. But I really had very little to do with that, and it wasn't connected to my medical past.
I was once on a plane, and I was discussing with someone that I was interested in computer graphics, and they were into medicine, and I thought we'd have nothing in common until they said they actually worked by escorting people in to be Pixar'd. And, so let me ask you this. If we run the clock forward slightly, while at SIDGRAPH in Los Angeles this year, you were celebrating 20 years of the commercial release of RenderMan. By my count, it's 25 years in 2009 since the 1984 billiard ball shot. And I was wondering if I could talk to you about the pool ball shot, because the 1984 shot and the papers that came out around that and the subsequent years were a real turning point in many levels. But also that image, perhaps, for me personally, just was an astonishing feat in realism at a time when everything else looked completely nothing like real. Was that image something that caught people by surprise at the time? Because it just looked so terrific with the motion blur and the reflections and everything.
Oh, thanks. That image was done by Tom Porter, who was one of my co-authors on this, and it was just a brilliant piece of work to come up with something that was artistic that conveyed the algorithms that we'd been working on. We knew that well, one of the things that was going to be important if we were really going to do special effects or animation was to take the camera into account and to make images that looked like they were actually taken by a camera. And that means that the camera shutter comes on and things move, and then the camera shutter goes off. And if you don't do that, it looks kind of, you know, jerky.
It's like stop frame animation, really.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not going to blend in. And you're going to look at it as a special effect, which this is a big part of our interest at the time because we were part of Lucasfilm at that point. You're going to look at it, and it's just not going to look right. You're not going to necessarily know why, but it doesn't fit in the. It wouldn't fit invisibly into the scene. Same thing with depth of field. You've got to get the camera's depth of field. You've got to match that, and that was a big problem. And so that was something we'd worked on and had a real breakthrough in terms of solving. And that picture that Tom did really captured that.
Am I right in thinking that that picture was done just by effectively at that point super sampling, in the sense that you were doing multiple frames and combining them? I mean, how advanced was the motion blur algorithm at that point?
Well, it was essentially the same algorithm we use today. It's still the state of the art today. Basically, the way it works is it's not just a matter of taking several frames and averaging them. And within each pixel, each pixel is just a single color. But to come up with that color, you have to look at the entirety of the environment inside that pixel and average it. One way to do that is to look at the color at several different points in that image.
You mean now spatially?
Spatially.
Yep.
Spatially. And you average them. So the first trick is that people had always done that sampling on a regular grid, and you always ended up with a little sort of microscopic aliasing. And it turned out that that was an artifact of the regularity of the grid, not the fact that they were done at points. So one way to look at this, it's called a Monte Carlo technique, is the general term for this. And the reason is that it's like
a roll of the dice.
Like a roll of the dice. It's like a Gallup poll. You're doing a Gallup poll of the pixel and saying you're looking at a random sampling and saying what's the average color. The trick was to make each of those samples have a slightly different time between the time the shutter opens and the time the shutter closes.
Well,
and that then averages in time as well. So you're taking a Gallup poll not only in space but also in time.
So this, of course, was at the time in that you were publishing the stochastic. I can't even say that.
stochastic sampling. Easy for you to say.
Thank you. and that was an amazing point for adding realism and removing jaggies and generally upping the level. But that paper wasn't published until, what, a year or two after the 84 image? Is that right?
Oh, it actually came out with the 84 image. It was the paper was published in 1984. Well, there were two papers. The first paper was published in 1984 and had the picture 1984 as an example in it. And that contained the broad ideas. More specifics of it came out at a paper that was submitted to TOG, Transactions on Graphics, at the same time, but wasn't published for another year or two.
And so if we were to sort of run the clock forward, as recently as 2005, you were publishing the Wavelet Noise paper, mm-hmm. How linear is the link between the noise discussion at 2005 and the and the sampling that we were talking about in 84.
The Wavelet Noise paper is kind of different. It goes back more to some of the shading, the programmable shading work that I'd done in 83, which was trying to make surfaces look, the shading of surfaces look more realistic. And at that point, there were two papers. One, I'd published a paper called Shade Trees that was about programmable shading. And Ken Perlin published his paper on Perlin noise, I think the same year. And people had used Perlin noise ever since.
Right up until 2005, yeah.
Yeah, but it turned out that there were problems that with aliasing that people had with Perlin noise that they had dealt with. And the way Wavelet Noise came about was sort of a combination of me thinking about the shading problem, and Tony DeRose, who's my co-author on this, who had done a lot of work with wavelets. And wavelets are really nice because they deal with aliasing in an extremely powerful way. And so we're able to apply that to the noise generation problem. And noise generation is important in shading because you want to have a lot if you shade real objects, they tend to have complex patterns, and there's a lot of randomness in those complex patterns. And it's sort of the key to how you get the randomness in there. So it's got randomness in it. It's used for shading. So it's related to stochastic sampling in that way, but the techniques are at the core of them are pretty different.
Yeah. And so if we were to look between those two, there's been a lot of advances, and Pixar's been particularly good at publishing and being a contributor to the community and doing that. And I was wondering if you could walk with me on some of the sort of key papers and moments for RenderMan and for the software side of the company in particular between the sort of early 80s and today. And, I mean, there are a few sort of obvious standout points. But I was wondering whether there are moments or papers that sort of struck you as being particularly significant turning points for the company.
Well, I think that there have been there are a number along the way that are significant improvements to the product. It's interesting, if I can just step back for a second on that, to look at this program that originally Lauren Carpenter and I had worked on the algorithms for it. I wrote the original one in 83, and it was a very, very small, simple program compared to what it is today. It's amazing what's happened to it over 20 years, really, of people working on it and improving it. Maybe the most, definitely, I would say the most significant part of that was Pat Hanrahan in 87-ish, who took the original shading language that I had and replaced it with the RenderMan shading language and the RenderMan interface. And that was the thing that really allowed any modeler to talk to it. It's a way how you told the program what you wanted it to do. And at the same time, so it provided a standard interface to it, and also a much more powerful way of controlling the shading. So that's probably the most significant advance. But there have been lots of others along the way.
It's pretty remarkable that the whole approach of RenderMan can accommodate the level of complexity that you've got with, say, photon bricks and photon mapping at the level of complexity that Wall-E was using, for example, and that is a continuum. It's not like you sort of got halfway along, threw everything out, and started all over. There really has been there's no way you could have envisaged, I hope, how far it was going to go in this period of time.
Right. Well, there's been a lot of major surgery along the way, and that's why I feel really fortunate that this thing that that Lauren and I started has grown under the hands of, with a lot of work by a lot of people. Dana Batali's leading the group now. There's just some phenomenally good engineers in there who are doing some remarkable things. And you're right that it's doing some things that it wasn't envisioned. We didn't envision that would be something it would do. But sometimes that might happen fairly easily, and sometimes it might happen with a lot of extensive changes under the hood.
So I can't push you for any sort of key points, like, I don't know, deep shadows or something that sort of came along that you just thought, oh, that's really a good one, and that's a big step up.
Well, deep shadows are a clear one. They turned out to be something that far more useful than anyone would have thought originally. I think that's one of the good tests, is if something was invented and put in there for one reason and then people used it for a lot of other things, that's a good sign. I think brick maps is another one. People they put that in. We use it all the time now for all kinds of things. Putting me on the spot, it's sort of hard to remember all the things that are there, because there have been a lot of them. Ray tracing, it originally didn't do ray tracing at all, and the reason was that we felt originally that a lot of the complexity that you would get in an ordinary scene came from the complexity of the shading and the complexity of the geometry. And if you look at the room around at the room we're in now, there's very little in here that actually would need ray tracing. So that was the reason we built the program to be it didn't include ray tracing. It was going to be really fast at dealing with a lot of complex geometry and complex shading.
Yeah, because there was like the micropolygon stuff. There was just like a whole lot of steps along the way that seemed right. to really fit in well and build out. But it wasn't for a time there. You were almost a holdout. I mean, the displacement mapping, the whole lot of things. But you were sort of a holdout on ray tracing.
And, absolutely. And then. When Pat Hanrahan developed the RenderBand shading language, he put ray tracing in it as a capability, but it wasn't implemented for years. And to put ray tracing into the existing algorithm was quite a feat, and it was really brilliantly done. But if you think about it, all ray tracing starts with the primary rays that go out and sample the basic visibility of the scene, and RenderBand does that quite well. And it was then in the shader when you decided you had a reflection or something, you now need to go sample the scene with a ray. They added that in very seamlessly. But that's a good example of something that was not easy to do. They did it, and it works great.
Let me, if I can, change tacks for a second and discuss CPU versus GPU. And there's a discussion with NVIDIA and others over the role of GPU and CPU and the OpenCL. And I was wondering what your view is. Are we at a particularly key point in the development of the industry where that role of GPU and CPU is shifted or is shifting? Or do you feel like it's not going to be the case that we're moving things over entirely at some point to a sort of a GPU hardware parallelized type solution?
Well, GPUs have become remarkably more capable. I think the biggest we use them for visualizing things, but not for the final images. And the reason for that is that the sort of complexity we need in the final images is beyond what the GPUs can currently do.
But is that a race that you're always likely to stay in front of them, and that because of the nature of the beast, they're going to be? Because it's like if the goalpost didn't move, they'd have caught you up years ago.
Right. But goalpost does keep moving, and the biggest bottleneck is not the capability of the GPU in itself, but it does. How do I say this? The GPU does a lot of what we need. It just doesn't do everything that we need. And I don't know that it will do everything that is needed for the kind of complexity that we're demanding. The problem gets to be that you can't send something off to the GPU to do part of the work and then get it back and continue working on it. Because the communications delay getting back in particular is really slow. So that means that unfortunately you've got this great capability that you can't take advantage of unless you're willing to send it off and have it do all the rest of it. So I'm hoping that over time there's more and more of a communications speed up between the CPU and GPU, because the GPU is great because it is so much faster than the CPU because it works on things in this streamed way. That's not what a CPU does. We have a little bit of, and that can handle a lot of what is needed in rendering an image. I think there are things that are always going to need the capability of a CPU. That is a small part of it, but it's an essential part of it. So either the GPU has to get the capabilities of a CPU, in which case of the GPU, or you've got to have some way to get it to the GPU and get it back so it can do the things it does, but you can interleave it with the things that you need the CPU to do. I'm hoping that things move in that direction, and it seems like things are moving increasingly in that direction, and I think as they do, we'll see we will be able to use GPUs more, which we'd love to.
Because you've tackled a lot of parallelization problems just in terms of farms, but it's a different sort of communication problem. But it's also a data management problem, isn't it, really?
It is, yeah.
So one of the great things about Pixar is, I guess, the that it's not either A, an academic research center, or B, it's not something that's just, to a certain extent, doing render man for the money, because, you know, it's a combination of the two. And I think one of the things that really is fascinating is we started by discussing the 1984 image, and I think I'm right in saying, though you might correct me, that the texture maps painted for the reflections in the balls were actually done by a young chap called John Lasseter.
That's correct.
And so it must be very rewarding for you now with the company to see how far it's come and how far so many people, not just people like John Lasseter, of course, but how many people have come with you over that period of time, because you know, the company is, to many respects, a haven in the industry that's, you know, both people stay with it a long time, but also they stay there and then move on to do other interesting things.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that it was very interesting to see and be there for was seeing this transition from really technology-centric to art-centric, because at the beginning, we didn't know how to do any of this. Ed Catmull had this crazy idea of wanting to make a feature-length animated film. Nobody knew how to do that. We didn't. We made a few short things that were very simple, and people had figured out how to do a little bit more complex shading. We didn't have any idea how to do motion blur depth of field. We didn't know how to handle millions of micropolygons, or, you know, that level of complexity. So at the beginning, our challenges were purely technical, and we were there inventing algorithms, making a few test pictures, just trying to get the basic capabilities in place. That really changed, and we would do a few pieces that were technology people doing art, like 1984, like Road to Point Reyes. There was programmable shading that was new, and we wanted to test that out on the road surface and the wood and things like that. Fractals were fairly new, and Lauren wanted to put those on for the rock and the hills. There was a new atmosphere shader. There was the Lindenmeyer systems that Alvie Ray Smith had done to make the plants. There was the grass that with particle systems for Bill Reeves. So all these were kind of the ingredients that went in, and we did the best we could in terms of making something artistic.
But the Genesis sequence was just an extraordinary, you know, and that's direct line from that one still.
Yes, the Genesis effect was actually done before the...
Oh, really?
Still. Yes, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It was, just a little bit. Because Bill Reeves had used the particle systems for the fire, and then we extended them to grass. Well, actually, Genesis effect, see, though, was driven not... It was driven by the needs of the movie, not by the needs of the technology. So one of the things I was going to say, that one of the things that changed when John Lasseter got there is clearly at that point the storytelling and the art was in the driver's seat. And we... our contributions, I think we had the good sense to realize that was the right place for it. That art should be driving this, not the technology. And it worked much better that way. For one thing, people really wanted to see it, you know, rather than something we would come up with on our own. And the other thing is that it started this sort of virtuous innovation cycle between art and technology. John Lasseter talks about it being how the art challenges the technology, and the technology inspires the art. So you look at something like Luxo Jr., we had a new shadow algorithm. Well, that was inspiring to John, so he wanted to make a movie and came up with Luxo Jr. Well, that's his story about this lamp that's very moving. It has nothing to do with testing the shadow algorithm. I mean, it's sort of incidental, right? But it was inspiring to John. At the same time, the art challenges the technology, and the way that works, from my perspective anyway, is that artists, they're just telling their story. They, because the story demands it, they ask for things they have no idea that are unreasonable. So they ask for things they don't know are almost impossible. And the technology people are too proud to say they can't do it.
Was that a good example about what happened, say, around fur and hair at the time of Monsters, Inc.?
Oh, absolutely.
Because that seemed to be one of those occasions.
Oh, absolutely. So we get ourselves into this problem. We finally managed to get out of it. But in Monsters, it's very interesting. We got two professors from tenured professors from Carnegie Mellon, David Baroff and Andy Witkin. And they had done cloth there at Carnegie Mellon and done things like dropping a tablecloth over a table and used simulation techniques from engineering to do a wonderful job of this tablecloth dropping on the table. So we had hired them. They came in to do Monsters, Inc., which involved one T-shirt on a little girl. That was it. And you figured this is going to be easy, right? How hard is one T-shirt? Well, if you talk to them, they'll tell you that they had no idea what they were getting into. And the problem is that animators exaggerate. And what part of the reason we love them is they make things bigger than life. It is full of things that are non-physical. So if you look at the T-shirt on Boo, you look at the animation of her, her arms go through her body sometimes. Well, you can't – what do you do with a cloth? You never have to deal with that in a real physical situation. So in some ways, what they had to do was to reinvent simulation for a non-physical world. So you've got to take something that's got physicality in it, but not just something that works in the real world of, that a physics applies to, but to make that work in non-physical worlds.
Sort of a caricature of physics in the sense that
absolutely.
You pick out that resonates.
Absolutely.
And
here's another example. There's a scene where Sullivan is where Mike is. There's a scene where Mike is running Sully through some calisthenics. And
yep.
He does twins in a bunk bed. And it goes you know, up high, down low, high, down low. If you calculate it out, there's about 100 G's worth of force on Sullivan at that point. I mean, that's just ridiculous. But, of course, it reads really well. That's part of why it's so appealing. Well, if you put 100 G's of force on his fur would come flying off his body. So you can't have that happen. So how do you have – that's why you have to reinvent the whole way the simulation works to make it work in this non-physical realm.
So looking back to where you were saying before the features, when you said that you did these sort of test films, but these original Pixar animation shorts were gold. I mean, they were just every year we looked forward to another one, and whether it be a tricycle looking sad or you know, whatever it was gold. And I wonder, do you you know, SIDGRAPH recently has moved away from, say, doing the electronic theatre. Do you think we should go back to something like that? I mean, do you think those snapshots, you know, are valid? I mean, or has feature films replaced that?
Well, I love short films. And we continue to do short films. I don't know if you've seen Presto and Wally.
And Bernie.
I just love it. It's Bernie. It's great, you know. And they are great for us because it's a way to, first of all, they're fun. Everybody enjoys them. It's a way for new directors and new art people to try out and, you know, get used to doing a film before it's a 2-hour long film. And it's a way to try out new technology too.
And some stories work well in that short format.
And some stories work well in that short format. There's an example. Gary Rydstrom did Lifted is something, and you know, it was his directorial debut. So it was great because he'd never directed a film before. He was a really talented filmmaker from the sound perspective, but it was a way for him to try out being a director, and it was great. So it would be hard to give someone a feature film to do without having done anything before, but. This is a way for them to
so obviously no loss of short film support from Pixar.
No, we love short films. We'll continue doing them.
So what are some of the issues on the research horizon? Not specifically any kind of roadmap or anything, but just roughly, what are some of the areas that personally interest you right now in the area of computer graphics research?
Well, here's what interests me is I think if you. With the exception of doing realistic humans, which is just really hard because of the uncanny valley and things, pretty much now we can simulate anything we want and have it work really well. It's a few years ago, I remember being at the SIGGRAPH film show, sitting with people who do this for a living and not really being able to tell what was an effect and what wasn't. And if you can fool the people who do it, it's really gotten to the point where it's really become invisible. And I think it's moved, computer graphics has moved special effects out of the realm of specialty films like science fiction into the mainstream. There are all kinds of mainstream movies today that use special effects. You don't even know they're special effects. It's just another tool in the filmmaker's tool set. But if you look at the process of getting those special effects to be invisible, it's really painful still. It is... the tools are still very much bear the mark of the original tools that were written by engineers for them to use as test cases and things, and it's just very painful and not intuitive. They're not very artistic tools. They're not very artist friendly tools, and so I'd like to see us get to where the tools we provide the artists are as, you know, invisible as the result is to the audience, where it's much more artist friendly. It's a very artists now who work on special effects have to work in a very odd way. It's like they have to take their artistic impulses, translate them into an analytical process to figure out what knobs to turn and what to do, and then do that. See the result, evaluate that in this right brain, intuitive, artistic way, but then translate it back into something left brain to know, and analytical to know what to do about it. I think there's something we could do. I think we could go a long way toward making these really artist tools.
Because you once said in an interview, I think about 4 years ago, that the thing you liked most about SIGGRAPH was not the iterative improvement paper, but the one that hit you from left field you didn't see coming.
Yes. Absolutely. Those are always the ones that are the most fun.
And so I guess if you were to be hit from left field over new ways of improving that dialogue with the computer, that would be a treat.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike and Rob. One thing listening to this that made me think about the industry and how young it really is, and how we don't have generations of people in this industry like a lot of other crafts and a lot of other businesses. I mean, this is really a young industry in the overall scheme of things. So it's great to get a lot of the history and document it as it's gone along. And I think we've done a very good job with that with the FX Guide TVs and inside of FX PhD. Getting a lot of that history and talking to people about how things have been done and how things are advancing. So it's great to have that kind of conversation. So that'll do it for this FX podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.